We have two sessions on Isaiah, and this is the end of the first session. Now, I do want you to know that there are 66 books, 66 chapters in Isaiah, and tonight we're on chapter 13. So if you want to open up your Bible to chapter 13, though you may recall that 2 weeks ago we looked at chapters 13 through 39. So I think we're on schedule, but I'm doubting very, very seriously that we will finish Isaiah 13 and 14 tonight. So I at least want to at least go through a lot of what is in 13. What is in chapter 13? Well, let's look at the maps because we're going to be talking about Babylon, and I hope you can see where Babylon is on the map that's on the screen. If you've got maps in the back of your Bible, I would really encourage you to use those maps in the back of your Bible, because places are meaningless, they're just a name until you've got a geographical place you can pinpoint it. And the next slide, and go ahead and put that next slide up, is the same general area, but you can see Babylon written in the red. I hope you can see all of that to give you some idea of the extent of the power that was held throughout the world by the Babylonians. Now, the Babylonian empire lasted only a very, very short time, less than 100 years. It reached its ascendancy when the father of Nebuchadnezzar, we know the name Nebuchadnezzar in association with that, when the father of Nebuchadnezzar made the kingdom as great as it was, Nebuchadnezzar was his general, and Nebuchadnezzar came over and came to Jerusalem in 606 B.C., and so we need to be aware of that. And 70 years later, and from 606, and that'd be what, 536, Babylon fell. So really about 70 years from the time they began to impact the Bible. Look at the next slide. I don't know if you'll be able to read the print that there. Is that print too small? I need you to shake or nod. Can you read that at all? It's just a slide of information about that. And that information is not necessarily important, but what it says, it's about 50 miles south of Baghdad. You think about Iran and Iraq. Baghdad is the capital of Iraq. Was an ancient city with a history of settlements dating back to the 3rd millennium B.C. People were there, but it was not a power, obviously. The greatest period of the city's history was in the 6th century B.C., so you get to the lower 600s, and we talked about 606 and falling in 535, so that's 6th century B.C., and that was during the time of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar would go on to even greater things than his father did, it says a little bit later in that, including the capture of Jerusalem when he came back, and finally, the first trip he took, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember those three guys four guys in the book of Daniel? And they came back a second time and destroyed the king and set up his own puppet king. And but he came back a third time, in which he really destroyed the city. It was an amazing city, a powerful city. And if you'll see the word Ishtar Gate was built in 575 B.C., with its fine towers and depiction of animals, and we're about to look at some slides that will give you some indication of the grandeur of it. It was destroyed in 535 B.C., and when Alexander the Great, 200 years later, came by, it was so decimated. I mean, they came in and they tried to level every bit of it. It was so decimated and covered up by sands and the blowing sands that was there, he would have bypassed the city. That's how complete the ruin of Babylon was. We're going to read about that tonight as we study this in Isaiah. 200 years before it ever happened, God said, here's what's going to happen to Babylon, and just need to be aware of it. But that's how much it was decimated. And it's a faith-building thing to think about all of that happens. And so that slide, go ahead and show that slide to the ruins of Babylon to give you some idea of what they've been able to discover. But it was lost. It was lost for nearly 2,000 years. It was only in the early 1800s they even found out where it was. I mean, here's this powerful city in the world. Nobody knew where it was. And finally, they were able to discover it. Go ahead and look at the next slide if you want to give you some idea of some of the buildings that are there. It is remarkable that when they found the walls of the city, they found the Ishtar Gates. And in the museum, in the Louvre in Paris, they came to Babylon and took the gate, the Ishtar Gate, and it has been reconstructed. The gate has been reconstructed in the Louvre, the museum there in Paris. And that's what the next slide is. It shows Babylon's Ishtar Gate. Now, I don't know how much you can see of that. I find it rather interesting. Look at how ornate and beautiful the blue wall is in relationship to that. If you look down over in the lower right-hand corner, you'll see a little piece of white paper and everything. That's the description. Museums have plaques that are there. And so a person standing there, that plaque's about waist high. To give you some idea of the magnitude of this one gate. There's another picture in the next slide of that same gate. And it gives you another depicting of it to give you some idea of it. Now, go ahead and look. Put a little person, you know, 5 or 6 feet tall right over there. You saw how big that was. And look at how big that gate was. It was an amazing. And so when the Bible says the glory of the Chaldees' excellence, Chaldea, Ur of the Chaldees, that whole region is called Chaldea. And the glory of Chaldea was Babylon. And this will give you some insight into it. You see all of those animals that are there, they are not small by any means. And it's interesting to begin to look at them. One of the animals is there. Does anybody notice anything unusual about that horse that is there? You see anything unusual? Dorothy sees it. What she's seeing is something that looks like this, right? And whether that is a pagan influence of the unicorn or not, I mean it is. I believe I see the horn there, don't you? I think I see something. He's got one long ear that's out of place. If that's not the depicting of the of some sort of horn that's there. Isn't that amazing? I find that absolutely amazing. And then let me just point out, Daniel saw this very thing. You can go to the Louvre and see the very same thing that Daniel saw. When Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken from Jerusalem, which was in ruins or was soon to be totally ruined and wiped out, the temple in Jerusalem was going to be destroyed when finally by Nebuchadnezzar, and to leave that and to walk over into Babylon and see the splendor, the great, great splendor of Babylon. And there's another one of the animals there. I want you to have a look at it, because when you think of Daniel, where do you think about Daniel in his life? Now, Daniel actually was over in Persia. The Medes and the Persians destroyed Babylon, and so it's over in Persia that Daniel was thrown in the lion's den. But I want you to think about, look at how magnificent that lion is. We think about lions being limited to Africa. I want you to understand that the evidence is such that it's the indication that when Samson killed the lion, and when David said, "The Lord delivered me out of the paw of the bear and the paw of the lion," this is what he was talking about. You know, they were not as regional as they are in our day, and so it's easy for us to think that, well, it was a mountain lion is what David had to deal with. That's all that Samson had to deal with. That's not the case at all. Let's look at the next slide, and this will help us introduce Babylon. And that is the first mention of Babylon is in Babel. You remember what the Tower of Babel was all about? It was in the plains of Shinar, and you know between those rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates River, that's where the plains of Shinar are. And they said, "Let us build a tower that will extend up into heaven, lest we be scattered over all of the earth." And that's where language came from. It's interesting to study evolutionists trying to explain languages, where they come from. It did not just start out with grunts. That's our view of where language comes from. I don't know if you heard about the the two men in sitting around in the cave, and one of them said, "Ugh," and the other one said, "Ugh," and the first one said, "Ugh," and the second one said, "Ugh," and the first one said, "Ugh," and the second one said, "Ugh, ugh," and the first guy said, "Quit changing the subject," and that's not the most complicated languages are the more ancient languages. You think about how much English has changed in our own day. If you even know what the subjunctive mood is, then you are an English major, or you made A's in high school in English. I'll guarantee you. Nobody uses it anymore. Not a part of our situation and everything. And how well could you name the eight parts of speech even in our own language and everything? It's remarkable. Languages change, and the more ancient the language are, the more complex they are. What does that tell you? That language did not come from cavemen grunting back and forth into each other. And now we are at the epitome of having the greatest language on earth. We've talked about the fact that, in English we've got present tense and past tense. The Greek language has four different past tense. And I don't want to spend much time there, but the Greek language can say in the past, "He used to do this. He was doing this." And, you just change one or two letters in the Greek verb, and it is, "He was doing this." John the Baptist was beheaded. Why? Not because he said to Philip, "It's unlawful for you to have your brother's wife." He was beheaded because he was saying to Philip, "It's unlawful," or saying to Herod, "It's unlawful for you to have your brother's wife." He was saying it. Saw him on Monday. "Hello, Herod. It's unlawful for you to have your brother's wife." Wednesday, "Unlawful to have your wife, your brother's wife." And I know Hollywood doesn't depict it at all, but in one of the Bible movies, I'll never forget when Herodias' daughter comes in to dance before Herod, that the prison that John is in is within earshot of that very room, and John is down there in that jail shouting out, "Herod, Herod, it's not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife." I know that's dramatic, and that there's no evidence that ever happened, but it could have. John was saying, "It's not lawful for you to have her." Every time he saw him, he said, "It is not lawful for you to have her." Babylonia is mentioned 295 times in the Old Testament. Jeremiah has nearly 150 of those times in the book of Jeremiah, because Jeremiah, who lives, Isaiah, Jeremiah, the book right after Isaiah. That was the time he lived. I mean, that's all he's talking about. The Jews are headed to Babylon, and so he's dealing with that. He writes about it often. And 12 times in the New Testament, the last mention of it is in the book of Revelation. 12 times in the New Testament, and in the book of Revelation, it's obviously figurative, because when Babylon was destroyed in 535 B.C., there's never been a Babylon. There's never been a Babylon. And so geographical places take on new meanings. If I say Iwo Jima, would that mean something to you? If I say, somebody help me, Pork Chop Hill, which war were you in? My Lai, is that the one you want? I don't know which one you mean. Six-Day War over there, all we got to do is just mention a geographic, Waterloo, think about that. Valley Forge, just think of geographical places. And so in the book of Revelation, that's symbolic. There's a message from God, but if you don't know the history of Babylon, you miss it. You have no idea who this could possibly be. You think, well, maybe Babylon had been rebuilt. No, we'll see. God said when it's destroyed in 535, it will never be inhabited. Now, Babylon impacted the Jews tremendously, because Nebuchadnezzar is the one who, beginning in 606 B.C., started destroying Jerusalem and finally destroyed the city and tore down the temple and took all of the furniture of the temple. Isaiah, 200 years before it, by it I mean Babylon, but I didn't have space to write the word Babylon, before Babylon reaches its ascendancy, said, "It will be destroyed and it will never be inhabited." Tell me, what's going to be the world power 200 years from now? Isn't that amazing? You absolutely don't have a key. Next time, in the next session, I'm going to show you where Isaiah names the king by name that was going to give the commandment, go back to the Jews, go back and rebuild Jerusalem. How would you like to name the president of the United States 220 years from now? You can't do it 200 days from now. I mean, or, you know, 300 days from now, whenever 2020 comes, however many days that is. But God was going to let Babylon destroy Jerusalem. Well, it looks like the Babylonian gods are greater than the gods of heaven. And that's one of the reasons this is here. You can imagine when one nation fought against the other, it was my God's greater than your God. And whichever God's the most powerful, that's the one that's going to reach ascendancy. And you use human wisdom, you'd look like the gods of the Babylonians, far greater than the gods of heaven. They just come in to even destroy the temple of God there in Jerusalem. Because it's not that way at all. Let me tell you, when God gets angry with Babylon, you wait and see what's coming. And that's where Isaiah is. Now then, let's get to chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13, the burden of Babylon. Your King James says the oracle of Babylon or something. And I'm going to skip down a few verses every now and then. And so we know it's a message to Babylon, but the whole message is Babylon is going to fall, starting in verse 4. Here is Isaiah, 750 B.C., talking about something that's going to happen 535 B.C. Is that 200 and, I don't know, is that 200 years? It's a long time. Well, 750 to 535 is 220 years, 215 years. The noise of a multitude is in the mountains like that of many people. A tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of the nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts musters the army for the battle. Guess what? God uses nations. And so here's the fall of Babylon described, and he said it's not just one nation. The nations are headed toward Babylon, and listen to the noise that they're making. Figurative language, not necessarily literal language, but figurative language, and the sound that those armies must make as they're headed over to this land. And because the affirmation is, the army is being mustered by God. We looked briefly in 3 or 4 weeks ago back in Isaiah chapter 10, where the king of Assyria is called the rod of God in the hand of God to destroy the northern kingdom. And that's what you have here. The Lord sent the Assyrians against that northern kingdom, and we've talked about that in previous weeks. We don't have time to go back and talk about all of that. But he used it. Guess what? In Jeremiah, Nebuchadnezzar is called the servant of God. That's a brand new concept. He doesn't even believe in God. And yet whenever the Lord needs Jerusalem to be destroyed, he uses one of his servants on this earth because he is the God of all the heavens and the earth. Verse 5 says, they come from a far country. Go ahead and put up the next slide. From the end of the heaven, the Lord and his weapons of indignation to destroy the whole land. Here's your affirmation. Destruction is coming. Now, it's important for us to recognize when Jeremiah is prophesying, Babylon is nothing. Babylon is nothing at the time that Jeremiah is prophesying. It's absolutely nothing. And we may come back and look as we have time tonight, where the first time Babylon's almost mentioned in one of the prophetic books in Isaiah, or pardon me, yes, in the life of Isaiah was Hezekiah's been sick and he's getting well. You remember he prayed that God might extend his life 15 years. And he's so thankful that the rulers of Babylon sends an envoy over to congratulate him. You know what Hezekiah does? He shows them all of the gold in the temple and all of the treasures and the magnitude of all that Solomon had built that, and or at least of what was left of all of that. And Hezekiah turns to Isaiah and says, they're from a far country. Don't worry about them. And Isaiah said, you've made a tragic mistake. 200 years later, Babylon needs gold. Guess where it is? There's that one temple built by Solomon where everything in it is covered with gold. We sometimes do not see that, but destruction is coming. And so look at the description of that day whenever the destruction does come. Verse 6 says, wait, for the day of the Lord is at hand. God has spoken, and it is ready. It is ready to happen. All of the things are in place, and it is coming. It will come as destruction from the mighty. And verse 9, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy the sinners from it. I've put there because it will help you understand something a lot, and that is the day of the Lord. The expression of the day of the Lord doesn't just originate, in a New Testament setting. The day of the Lord is a day of judgment. And so whenever John is saying, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, it may be that because of the visions that he is about to receive of the coming of the judgment of God, that is exactly why John says, I was taken in the Spirit to the day of the Lord. And I don't have any problem calling Sunday the Lord's Day. Every day is the Lord's Day. But whenever that expression, the day of the Lord, is used 20 times in the Old Testament, it's always a day of judgment. And this is just one illustration of it. And you'll see that all the way through the minor prophets. Every time there is a day of judgment that is coming. And then look at the last verse on this particular slide, verse 9. It says, behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy sinners from it. Cruel, wrath, fierce anger. You don't mess around with God. And you'd better not mess around with God's holy temple there in the city of Jerusalem. Ark of the Covenant. Perhaps at that time they still had the pot of manna inside that Ark of the Covenant. Likely did not. Aaron's rod that budded. The most holy place on earth. Don't you get God upset. Don't you get God upset. And in Matthew 24, and that's another whole study, the worst tribulation that ever came on this earth was when God got angry. And this is just, this is not, obviously not that tribulation, but when God gets angry. You remember as a child when your mama or daddy got angry? I think about King Agag. Remember King Agag and what he said? You remember Saul was told to go down and utterly destroy the Amalekites? And he brought back the best of the animals and everything. And King Saul came back and said, I've done everything God told me to do. And Samuel said, wait a minute, what's that I'm hearing? I'm hearing the lowing of the sheep and the bleating of the lowing of the cows, the cattle, and the bleating of the sheep. What's that noise all about? Now here's Agag. They've destroyed everybody except the king. Of all the folks you would destroy if you're going to try to keep the will of God, you get rid of that king. He's the main cause. Evidently, they brought him back as a trophy so everybody could praise God. I'm not sure exactly why. The only motivation I see for them bringing him back. So, immediately, they destroy those animals that are there. Samuel says, God's going to take the kingdom away from you, King Saul, because of what you've done. And finally, he turns to King Agag. And I love what Agag said. And maybe you thought about it with your parents when Agag said, "Surely the wrath is past." Mom and Dad, you're still not angry, are you? When God gets angry, the way we look at it may be cruelty, but that's not the way God looks at it, because He will destroy the sinners. Let's look beginning at verse 10 and look at some of the things that are in verse 10. Because here is some language that evidently is figurative. I think we'll be able to show that as we continue the study of this. But when nations fail throughout the Old Testament, the fall of that nation is described in similar words again and again. The stars of the heavens, their constellations, the sun and the moon. Verse 13, the shaking of the heavens and the earth moving out of its place. When God gets angry, it's going to be a time of great, great upsetting. We have this in a lesser degree in English, figurative language. Well, I tell you, yesterday was really a cloudy day for me. You don't think the weather? You understand that figurative language. Well, I'm telling you, the roof fell in on me. If you know that expression, you don't think that they need somebody to come put a new roof on the house. And the Jewish mind, because of the use in the Old Testament, we don't have time to do this, but we're going to study Revelation in about another 10 weeks on Sunday morning. We're going to study Revelation. We're going to talk about this very sort of thing. We're going to look at time after time in the Old Testament when this language, Babylon is fallen. How's it described? It is when God gets angry, the whole world is going to be impacted figuratively. Stars going to fall out of the heaven. The moon's not going to give its light. And the sun and the constellation and the heavens will be shaken. The earth will be shaken. And when figurative language is used over and over and over again, because it becomes a part of one's culture, you do not think of it literally. If I say to you, "He swallowed that hook, line, and sinker," You never think literal. You're programmed every time you hear that expression. You know, I got this straight from the horse's mouth. Really? What if you're Japanese? And you don't know English and you don't know English idioms and everything? And you're at the United States, President Trump's talking to President whoever he is, the Prime Minister of Japan, and said, "I want to tell you, I got this straight from the horse's mouth." How'd you like to be the translator there? How are you going to translate if you translate what he says, he's going to absolutely, totally miss it. And here's our problem, folks. Whenever we hear about the stars falling out of heaven, we always first think literally. And here is a beginning place to understand you don't necessarily need to think literal. And we'll talk about that, look at a whole lot of verses, 10 or 12 weeks from now when we're studying the book of Revelation together. But it is a Jewish idiom, and they never would have thought of it literally. We don't have time to discuss that, but we'll do that in 12 weeks whenever we get to studying the book of Revelation. Now then, Babylon is falling because God's nature demands it. Look at verse 11. Where there's evil, wickedness, iniquity, arrogance, pride, haughtiness, and that which is terrible, God has got to move against it. Does anybody remember what Nebuchadnezzar did in Daniel chapter 4? He had a dream, that's the first part of that chapter. The fulfillment of that dream came whenever Nebuchadnezzar walks around Babylon, Ishtar Gate, Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Haven't you had a chance to talk about that? One of the seven wonders of the ancient world right there. The walls of Babylon, according to Herodotus, were 350 feet up into the air. One building in that city was 600 feet up into the air. How'd you like to build that scaffolding, Dirk? 600 feet up into the air. I mean, you just stop and think about all that they did in relationship to this. It's amazing. I don't know how they did it. Never going to say, look how great I am. I am as great. He almost says, I am as great as God. In fact, the implication is, I'm greater than God. And God says, that's it. They're going to drive you right now. While these words were in his mouth, they're going to drive you out away from the palace, and you'll go out in the wilderness, and your hair will grow long, and it'll evidently get dirty and filthy, and your hair will look like eagle's feathers, and the claws of your fingernails will grow, and you'll have the claws of a wild animal, and you'll be eating grass until you learn, God says, that I am in charge. And that reference to arrogance and pride and haughtiness is one of the reasons Babylon fell. When God gets angry, look down at verse 13. Therefore I will shake the heavens and the earth will be moved out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts and in the day of his fierce anger. That's amazing. The book of Revelation says he'll pour out his wrath without measure. You know the word infinite? God's wrath can be infinite, unmeasurable. And the Jews need to really, really understand that. Look at the desolation in verse 14, like a hunted gazelle. And look how all-inclusive it is in verse 14. Every man will turn to his own people, and everyone will flee to his own land. Look at the total destruction that was going to come. Starting back up in verse 15, everyone, and verse 16, children and wives, and you will see your children dashed to pieces before your very eyes. When the Persians came in, this city that nobody could take, walls 350 feet up in the air came in, and they saw their own wives ravished and their children smashed against pillars there in the city. They knew, by the way, the army of the Medes and the Persian was outside. The river Euphrates ran right through the middle of Babylon. They had enough food inside Babylon to last for 20 years. Go ahead, Medes, bring your army up in, park it outside, and when your 30-year-old soldiers are 50 years of age, then we'll talk to you about battle. And we'll be fat, and you'll be starving to death, and be eating your horse's bridles. You know, the original jerk is what you'll be eating. Look again, this time, and see the that God specifies the very nation that will destroy it. He says, I will stir up the Medes against them. They will not regard silver, and as for gold, they will not delight in it. He even names the nation that's going to destroy Babylon. When Isaiah writes, it's not Media that's the power. It's not Babylon that's the power. It is, as we studied in the earlier weeks, it's Syria and it is Assyria. It's Damascus and it's Nineveh. They're the powers. When Isaiah writes, and he says, by the way, God's going to get angry with Babylon and the Medes and the Persians. 535 are going to overnight destroy the city of Babylon. I may have that slide twice. Look down where the prophecy is. It was 200 years before Babylon's destroyed. I just put that slide in here just to remind you. This prophecy was made 750 B.C., and it was fulfilled in 535 B.C. This is an amazing prophecy. And now look at verse 19, and we're not going to get as far as I thought we might get tonight. Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' prides, will be as when I overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Jude says Sodom and Gomorrah is God's warning of His judgment against sexual immorality, of the eternal punishment that's going to come on those who are immoral. God got angry at Sodom and Gomorrah. And God said, I am going to overthrow you like I overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 20, it will never be inhabited. It'll never be inhabited. Nor will it be settled from generation to generation, nor will the Arabians pitch tent there, nor will the shepherds make their sheepfolds there. What happened to Nagasaki? What happened to Iwo Jima? What happened to San Francisco when the earthquake came? What happened to Chicago when the fire came? What happened to Rome when Rome burned during the days of Nero? Destroyed cities are always rebuilt. God said, I'm going to wipe Babylon out so much it will never, ever be inhabited. In my lifetime, and I mentioned this once before, two men said, I'm going to rebuild Babylon. Petrol crisis back in the early 70s when gas prices just zoomed out of sight and all the money in the world went over to the Arab nations. When all of that was happening, there was a fellow over there in Iran called the Shah of Iran. Filthy rich. And he said, I am going to rebuild Babylon. You remember what happened to him? Overthrown, could almost not even find one nation that it would accept him to let him live in that nation. I believe he died of cancer down in Mexico. I've forgotten all the details about it. I am going to rebuild Babylon. No, you will not. I don't care how many petrol dollars you've got. It'll never be inhabited. And then there's another guy whose name you will more readily recognize, Saddam Hussein. When the American army headed into that land and became an influence in that world, guess what he was in the process of doing? Rebuilding Babylon. It will never be inhabited. I've got 4 minutes. I don't know what to do with 4 minutes. Look, what'd you say? I'm sorry, Lynn.
Why would you do the Shah and then also, you know, Saddam Hussein? What's the interest in rebuilding it?
Why? What? I still didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Why do they want to rebuild Babylon?
Oh, because I'm the greatest. If I can do that, then I can become the next ruler of the world. I mean, that's the whole purpose of it and everything, to show the splendor of it. Look at Dubai. Dubai is an illustration of it. Think of all of the tallest buildings in the world are in Dubai, and everybody's got a standard of living that's just out of sight. And Dubai is the greatest nation on earth. Exact same principle and everything. Let's look. Go to week 8 and look at that first slide there. In lesson 8. I must have my. I don't even have the slide that I want to have. You have a slide that says yes. Verse 4. Take up this proverb against the king of Babylon. I don't believe I don't seem to have that slide. Take up this proverb against the king of Babylon. Chapters 13 and 14 are tied together, and knowing how long it's going to take to talk about Babylon, when we get to chapter 14, the very same thought is found in chapter 14. Now, unfortunately, we're going to have to take a break for 2 weeks on Wednesday night in relationship to this. So we won't be able to continue what's in chapter 14, but understand that God, having talked about all of these things, now turns his attention to Nebuchadnezzar And he was not actually the king that reigned right at the end. It was his grandson. I think the old King James says his son. It was Nebuchadnezzar's grandson that saw the handwriting on the wall. You remember that, Daniel 5? Nebuchadnezzar's grandson saw the handwriting on the wall. He was having a drunken feast. Guess what they're drinking out of? The golden vessels that came out of the temple in Jerusalem. They're filling those vessels with alcohol of some kind and toasting their gods. When all of a sudden, the hand of a man writes on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And nobody's able to interpret it. Daniel is in the land, and Daniel said, goes to Belteshazzar and says these words. And Daniel 5 says, you're weighed and balanced in the balance of God, and you're found lacking. But all that you can say about how great you are up against the God of heaven, and there's no comparison, you're coming up really, really short. You've been weighed in the balances, and you've been found wanting, been found lacking. And he says, this night, your kingdom will be taken from you. You know what the Persians did? You cannot get over a wall 350 feet up in the air. You don't have a ladder long enough. You don't even have a rope long enough. They need to have no way of getting that rope up that high. You know, I just cannot do it. Well, how did he destroy it? Well, you couldn't dig under it. The foundation went down to bedrock. The Medes came and went up river of the river Euphrates and diverted the course of a river as great as the Mississippi River. Dug canals up there, and that massive river that was the lifeblood of that of Babylon, they diverted the course of it. It stopped the water flowing. They had iron gates that went down deep into the river. So if there ever was anything like low tide, that wouldn't be but a dry season, you couldn't get into this city. And all of a sudden, the Persian army, the army of the Medes and the Persian, marched up that riverbed. And that very night, destroyed the king. Now that's where we're going to start. Wednesday night, three Wednesday nights from now, we'll have two other Wednesday nights, and then we'll start back up with the second study of Isaiah. We've got a lot to go. There's still so much. I'm having to leave out so much, and I hope you're not getting lost, trying to keep it as simple as I know how. Thank you very much for being here.